quote from the Worthland Worldwide Group. It surveys environmental attitudes, and I think this is a good summary or a good introduction to where we are. It says, environmentalism has become deeply rooted in the U.S. national psyche. Since its extremist beginning 30 years ago, environmentalism has matured, gaining popular support and becoming a part of the mainstream. In the process, it has gained a great deal of momentum. I think that momentum is exactly the reason why the Philadelphia Society has chosen to focus on environmentalism this weekend. And it's a momentum that is truly very important. It offers a lot of opportunities and a lot of challenges for those of us who are interested in the ideals of freedom. Thanks to the seemingly harmless and universal appeal of environmental preservation, the environment opens a door, it opens an avenue for to tap into areas that have only tenuous links to what some of us might call legitimate environmental concerns. Now certainly, as speakers before me have said, there are all kinds of environmental problems, and we need to deal with those. And we need to deal with those within the context of the science, as Fred Singer has pointed out, within the context of the risk, as Steve Malloy was pointing out, and within the context of trade-offs and a number of other things. But I think it would be a problem if we walked away from here thinking that everything was fine, because there really are tremendous challenges to the ideal of environment and freedom, or the concept of freedom for the environment, or environment of freedom. So however we want to look at it, I think what I'd like to focus on is the insidious nature of environmentalism. Really, as Bill Dennis said yesterday, we can't talk about the environment because the environment means many things to many people. And really, that in essence is the problem. Today, environmentalism means anything that any social advocate wants it to be. And that, to me, is the problem. I think that what I'd like to do today is summarize a few high-profile cases to remind us what is at stake if we do not clarify our environmental vision and offer a better perspective of what an environment of freedom can offer. Those of you who are familiar with Brian Tracy, those who are here, in fact, just for the resource thing, heard how he mentioned how important it is for us to clarify our goals, our vision. And I think as we struggle here with what we can do, one of the things that I think has worked and that we can continue to refine is that communication tool of putting a human face on environmental regulations. How is it that environmental regulations affect you and affect me? And as you hear these stories, I think it's easier for people, regardless of what their political philosophy is or their political affiliation is, to begin to relate a little bit more to what environmental regulations do or can do to us and for us. And the first story I'd like to tell is one that has been referred to here. It's the one about John Schuler, a Montana rancher. I'd like to give you that story a little bit more in detail because one thing I realized is while those of us on the panel spend our lives on these issues, many of you here don't know the fuller context of some of these stories. Well, this story is about, it happened in 1989 when this rancher who had been losing sheep to what he thought was were grizzly bear attacks, he heard a ruckus out near his sheep pens, grabbed his gun, went out, and in fact saw a couple of grizzlies out by his sheep. He fired some warning shots, and that was sufficient to scare them away. As he turned around to return to his house, he saw another grizzly rear up on his hind legs, spread its paws, and let out a great roar. Now, he did what any of us would do with gun in hand, and he shot and fatally wounded this bear. Now, thinking, of course, that he had done nothing wrong, he notified the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and it charged him with violating the Endangered Species Act and fined him $8,000. Well, following an administrative law judge's ruling from the U.S. Department of the Interior, the fine was put at $4,000, and interestingly enough, the judge accepted Schuler's argument that his life was in danger, but he claimed that he could not take the self-defense exemption of the Endangered Species Act because the wording was he eminently put himself in the zone of danger. Well, this fine was increased to $5,000 by an ad hoc appeals board employed by Secretary Babbitt. They rejected the self-defense plea, and they increased the fee because they said Schuler's dog warned him of that attack by going on point and so provoked the bear. Well, 7 years after the attack, Schuler was able to file a lawsuit against Babbitt in which, and this is where it relates to the kinds of things we care about, he charged that the previous holdings conflicted with well-settled principles of law: self-defense, the right to bear weapons, and the right to use those weapons on one's property, particularly when life and property are in danger. Well, this is a good story. I'm pleased to report that those of you who do not know, last month there was a good ending to this story. Thanks to the Mountain States Legal Foundation, who challenged this case, the U.S. District Court of the District of Montana ruled for Shuler, vacating both his conviction and his fine. Now, in speaking to Perry Pendley, who heads the Mountain States Legal Foundation, it's a limited victory because the wording from the judge was that, you know, don't let this get to your head. If any of your other friends feel like shooting a bear or something like that, they better have the resources and the time to defend themselves once again. We'll see how this plays out. The second story that I think is worth telling, that again puts a human face on these things and asks, you know, how are these environmental regs working in terms of maybe what was intended then? This one concerns wilderness areas, and it's not the traditional wilderness story that you might envision. As you may know, environmental advocates have asked for wilderness areas, a sort of cathedral, so to speak, where you could go out in the woods and leave nothing but your footprints and have this great experience with nature. And of course, that has raised all kinds of debates about what can occur in a wilderness area. You know, can you have mountain bikes? Can you have bikes? Can you have motorcycles, snowmobiles, and so on? Well, pretty much nothing. You cannot have motorized vehicles. And like it or not, that's where the law stands. The interesting challenge came in 1996 when Bobby Unser, a three-time winner of the Indy 500, was charged with violating the Wilderness Act of 64. He was riding snowmobiles on a sunny day with a friend near the San Juan Wilderness area, and a blizzard unexpectedly came upon them. As visibility dropped, they became hopelessly disoriented, and they were lost in the wilderness, or the forest that they had entered. And one of the snowmobiles broke down. They both hopped on the one they had left, and they eventually had to abandon it. The snow got so high. They wandered for a day and a half in waist-deep snow, spent the night in a cave, and fortunately found their way the next day to a farmhouse where they were able to call for help. Again, thinking they had done nothing wrong, they asked the Forest Service if they had found their snowmobiles, at which point they were charged with violating the Wilderness Act, a federal crime. At the trial in Denver, Unser was found guilty and fined, and the details, as I hear them, are really pretty incredible, and there's a part of me that almost hopes they aren't true. Apparently, the judge went into his back chambers, and he took a painting off the wall and used the wire hanger and a topographic map, and from the odometer readings of the snowmobile, concluded they must have wandered into wilderness areas. And Unser, in fact, concedes, "I don't know where I was. I might have, but believe me, I had no criminal intention, and I did not intend to wander." The interesting point from a rights-based story is criminal intent was not an issue here. Incredibly, the government attorneys argued that the prohibition against such motorized vehicle use is, quote, a public welfare offense. It did not require criminal intent because it affects people's primitive enjoyment of wilderness areas. The Mountain States Legal Foundation has asked for oral arguments, so stay tuned to this one. I don't know how it ends. I can go on and on, but I don't have time, of course, to rehash many stories that are familiar to people that are good ones. But I think the next point I'd like to make is that some of these stories are showing up now and coming from regular folks in regular magazines. And I think that shows the power of these types of stories. They're dismissed by environmental advocates as right-wing anecdotes, but I think the reason they're dismissed is because they are powerful and that we need to continue to tell these stories. Let me share one that I read in Newsweek magazine, certainly not a right-wing magazine, but just pretty mainstream. And in this one, it's about Superfund. We all know great stories about Superfund, and Steve Malloy yesterday pointed out that there are no adverse health effects that have ever been traced to a Superfund site. But nonetheless, a few days before her 84th birthday, Mrs. Scott of Oregon received a letter from the state saying that a building that she bought shortly after her husband's death when she was just 38 years old is potentially responsible for contaminating the city's groundwater. You see, in 1952, When her husband died, Mrs. Scott did not want to depend on the government to take care of her in her old age, so she bought this little building. It opened its doors with a children's clothing shop on one end and a dry cleaner on the other, and it operated that way for 25 years until those owners retired. It was replaced by a florist, and no big deal. It served that purpose of giving her security until this letter came, and the dry cleaner had ceased operations more than 20 years before this letter came, but the state claimed that it was a likely source of contamination. Now, the building was appraised at $70,000. In combination with every other asset she owned, including her house, it did not approach the $200,000 that the state estimated it would cost her to test for possible contamination and to fix the problem. Those of you who are familiar with the Superfund law know that it involves joint and retroactive liability and all these things that basically mean it doesn't matter when it occurred, when the harm occurred. It doesn't matter if it was in compliance with the law at the time. It doesn't matter if you contribute one millionth of the potential contamination, but you're responsible for the entire thing, unless you finger other people. And that's what she was encouraged to do. She was asked to take action against the dry cleaner, or to seek payment from the suppliers of the chemicals to the dry cleaner, or because this was before environmental hazards were written out of liability insurance, she was asked to go after the insurers of that company. But regardless, she had to pay the entire cost. This is what her daughter writes of the incident. The crippling realization that she could at any time be stripped of the means to support herself financially seems to have invaded her very cell. Her legs ache. Some days now, she leans on a chrome walker, unable to carry her own weight for her first time in her adult life. Surely, this was not what we intended when we assessed the environmental transgressions of our past and set out to clean up the errors we made as a society on our way to the American dream. I don't know if that's so short, but the one thing I can say is that if there's any sympathy in this case at all, if there's any reason Newsweek was willing to publish it, I'm sure it's because it was an 84-year-old old woman. It was a single person. Now, if we take somebody who agrees with the horrors of that story and instead substitute a Walmart or anything that might symbolize corporate America, the rights infraction would be lost, and instead the whole battle would be shifted to, you know, how corporations get what they deserve, or some such other line of reasoning. Well, another, I'll just tell one more story. You know, I have about 10 I want to share with you. Those airplane magazines, sitting right in front of me on a recent trip, and of course the title caught my eye, How Green Are the Greens? And this was about developing greenways, and it's no surprise, the developers are used to all kinds of things, from wetlands problems to wildlife and whatnot, and it went on to tell how all these green golf course developers, all the different things that they have done to accommodate environmental reactions, and some of them are pretty incredible. Ranging, like one town put a full-time policeman in to make sure that no environmental horrors occurred at the same time that they were developing and whatnot. One developer who had budgeted $1 million in 1 year ended up spending $3.5 million in 3 years developing this course, and he had to include a $2 million sewage plant that he gave to the city. He had to set aside $7.5 million eagle boundary and 200 acres of waterfront land for a federally managed preserve. That stuff, it's becoming old hat. But another developer then said, that's extortion. And he decided to test his theory. When he decided to go ahead and put in a golf course and purchase New York, he set up a sting operation. And sure enough, the environmental advocates promised to help a bogus environmental investment group obtain the property against the developer in return for hefty donations. He sued, they disappeared, but it led to that title story, How Green Are the Greens? I'll just tell two quick nonsense, if only they were nonsense stories, and then I'll end, because Rich has already given me my 5-minute thing. Oh, terrible. This one is just a follow-up on the religious freedom one that we had yesterday. Great area, we really need to go ahead and get. I don't know that much about this, but I think the audience will be interested in a clipping that I've kept in my files from Cato. Two Amish hunters in Ohio were fined $50 each for refusing to wear bright orange safety clothing. Their defense was that it's against their religion to wear bright clothing. It made no difference, even though they were hunting on their father's property. I think these are good stories. The last one I'm going to tell from my boss, Alex Schaffelman, a colleague of many of these friends here, because his pet peeve is one that I'm about to come up against personally, and that is low-flow toilets. And thanks to water regulations, we don't have a problem with water in our country, and it certainly is a recyclable and a renewable resource, but as many of you may know, the 1992 Energy Policy Act required manufacturers to reduce water consumption of new toilets from 3.5 gallons per flush to 1.6. Now, when the government is involved in the flushes of our toilets, it's a really big deal, but we heard yesterday how CFCs are big contraband. I can tell you, high flush toilets are big contraband, because if I'm in the process of redoing my bathroom, my plumber, who's from Uzbekistan and has rather interesting ties to different communities, promised to me that for a price, he can give me a high flush toilet. Ideals of freedom. And I think that what we have to do is offer a clear vision of environmentalism. That's a vision offered on environmental freedom, on what freedom can offer in terms of our abilities to protect, preserve, and enhance the environment in ways which reflect human innovation and human stewardship. Hopefully through this commitment, we can make a difference in the environment while at the same time preserving the virtue of freedom. Thank you.